Hi, and welcome to the Finally Pregnant podcast, the podcast for those who are finally pregnant and parenting after infertility and loss. I'm your host, Kat Strawbridge, and after almost 7 years trying with multiple rounds of fertility treatment, which sadly included pregnancy loss, I became finally pregnant in 2018, and I'm now finally parenting my gorgeous daughter, Ren. This season of the Finally Pregnant podcast is sponsored by Melio. Melio offers blood tests before, during, and after pregnancy, from non-invasive prenatal tests to general health checks, helping you and your family take control of their health. All Melio tests are conducted by trained professionals at locations throughout the UK, with the results sent directly to your phone or laptop. Plus, every test comes with a personal health report from a Melio doctor. Melio. The more you know about your health, the more you can do about it, and the best source of knowledge is your blood. To find out more or to find a location near you, visit meliohealth.co.uk/health-pregnancy. There'll be a link in the show notes. We've also recorded a bonus episode of the Finally Pregnant podcast with Melio doctor Donna Fullerton, where we take a closer look at non-invasive prenatal testing. Check out that bonus episode in season 4 of the Finally Pregnant podcast, wherever you listen to your podcasts. Hello there. How are you doing? I have been a little bit MIA the last couple of weeks because sadly our final round of fertility treatment, our very, very last frozen embryo transfer, didn't work. And well, I can't even tell you how heartbreaking it's been, to be honest. I know that I've shared a couple of things on Instagram, and I just want to say a huge thank you to everyone who has reached out, you know, and just expressed their love and a support for me and our family. It has been just so incredible. So thank you so much. I can only describe, well, I can't describe, and I will go into it in more detail in a couple of episodes' time. But right now, it's quite difficult to face it still. But I wanted to bring the podcast back because I've got a few interviews that I'm really excited to share with you ultimately, including today's. What I will say is that in all the years of trying to conceive and loss, I genuinely have never cried so hard that I thought I was going to be sick. Like, I literally ran into the bathroom the next morning when I was crying and had to hang over the toilet because I was going to be sick from crying. It is devastating and it's so final. And I think that, yeah, after a decade of hope, the fact that we have to let go of that, I can only describe it as if someone had died. I really can. And I just, like I say, I will go into it in more detail and the impact it's had on me and all the thought processes and all of that in an upcoming episode. But for anyone who has been through that final round and it not worked, I just want to, yeah, say that I'm here if you need me. And I'm sending you all my love because it's really, 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 really fucking hard. It really is harder than I thought it was going to be, actually, I have to say. But if that last decade has taught me anything else, it's that time is the best healer. And all throughout, even the last couple of weeks, I've thought, you know, I'm going to sit with this and I'm going to cry and I'm going to feel everything I need to feel. But I do know that I am going to get through this. And I know that in a few weeks' time, I'm going to feel better. In a few weeks' time, a bit more better, you know, and that time, yeah, will heal me. But I am sitting with how I'm feeling at the moment. And that feels good. And taking a step back from everything has felt really kind of like the right thing to do. And I want to say a huge thank you to Jess, who is our community manager over at the Hangout, because she has been looking after my support groups for me. And to Sim and Nikki, who always run the yoga and Pilates sessions for me in such a special way. And if you are pregnant right now, please, please know that I am here for you. And if you're parenting and trying for a second or third, I am here for you. I really, now more than ever, it's so important for me to keep doing the work that I'm doing. And someone wrote the most beautiful comment, which I did share on Instagram, about my maternal reach having gone so much further than Ren, you know, and it touching so many other mummies and babies. And honestly, that was just the biggest compliment that I could ever receive. And I want to continue doing this work so much. So if you're thinking about reaching out and telling me you're pregnant, if you're thinking about reaching out and, you know, asking for advice, don't hesitate, okay? Because I totally can deal with my feelings and everything that's going on around me in my own way, talking to the people that I need, and also support you and everything you need. So please, please, please reach out if you need it. Today's episode, moving on, is with the beautiful Miranda Ward. Now, Miranda reached out and shared her book with me, which is Adrift: Field Notes from Almost Motherhood. And it talks about her experiences of trying to conceive, the TTC years, as I call it sometimes. And it is a beautiful book. It really is. Miranda's hugest hobby is swimming, which some of you may have, you know, well, depends if you're swimmers or not. I know that I definitely took a break from going into swimming pools while I was trying to conceive. And, you know, but, and so it talks about kind of not only her emotional roller coaster through the TTC years, but also the impact it's had on her life and her hobbies and, you know, the way that she deals with stress and all of that kind of thing. It's just, it's a really, really, really important read, actually, because just like this podcast, even if you are looking back upon a different time, it can be really validating to read things and experiences from other people that really resonate with you. So just because you're past the TTC years, it doesn't mean that this might not be a good book for you to read, if you know what I mean. So yeah, do check it out. And I will put a link in the show notes to it. But Miranda, I'm really pleased to say, even following years of fertility treatment and loss, that she has got a little boy who was just over a year old when we spoke several years ago. And yeah, I really thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. She talks all about her pregnancy and a little bit about the TTC years, but about the pregnancy and birth. And yeah, she's a really, 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 really special lady. So do enjoy our conversation. I hope that you do enjoy it as much as I did. Before you go, I want to remind you, you're not getting away with it. And actually, I have news, non-Apple listeners. but wherever you listen to the podcast, please do subscribe and rate. And as I said, if you're on Apple, please, please leave a review on Apple because they are really, really important. If you're not on Apple, you can head over to the podcast link on my website because I've just created this new page. I'll put a direct link into the show notes as well. And all being well, I believe that you can leave a review there, even if you're not on Apple. So please, this is your moment, people. All of that. Oh, no, I can't do it because it's not on Apple. This is your time. Do it, please, for me, for all of the other people around the world who need to hear this. The more it's reviewed, the more you subscribe and rate, the more people it reaches. It's really as simple as that. So please, please do go and do that. And yeah, just hope you enjoy our conversation. I will be back soon and take care. Lots and lots of love. Bye-bye. In addition to this podcast, you'll find lots of other support for the wonderful Finally community over on my Instagram at Trying Years and at catstrawbridge.com. Examples of that support include the Finally Pregnant yoga and Pilates courses and a wonderful community called The Hangout. When you join The Hangout, which you can do whether you are pregnant or parenting, you'll receive a free meditation, access to 24/7 support, invitations to monthly speaker sessions and support groups, discounts, and lots more. Find out more about all of the support available to you at catstrawbridge.com. There's a link in the show notes. Hi there, Miranda. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Oh, really good. Really good. It's good. Lovely to have you here with me today. I am delighted to say that I read your book Adrift and I just thoroughly enjoyed it. And that focuses on your trying to conceive journey. And I love that you talk about that period, you know, in such detail, because we need to hear it, don't we, when we're going through it. And I liken it, as I was reading it, to Jessica Hepburn's Pursuit of Motherhood. And, you know, it's like people need to read this story to really get inside the heads of people who are going through it. And also for us as patients to kind of validate our journey and help us realize that we're not on our own, and people feel and experience and deal with things, you know, similar but different to us. But we're all in this together. So thank you for writing that. And there will be a link in the show notes if people want to check that out. But today we're going to be talking about your pregnancy and parenthood, subsequent parenthood. So perhaps if you could start from the beginning, talk about your trying to conceive journey and then how you felt when you were finally pregnant.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much for having me. And I really agree with what you're saying there about trying to record that period of what it's like to want to have a baby and just not know if you're actually going to be able to. And so our journey started, I was quite young, I was still in my 20s. The classic youthful optimism, went off birth control, thought it'll be a couple months at most. You know, I've spent my whole adult life up until now trying to prevent pregnancy, so how hard can it be? And of course, it took us over a year to conceive. And then that ended in miscarriage. And then I had subsequently over the next few years, another miscarriage, an ectopic pregnancy. We started IVF. I miscarried at 12 weeks. And then we did a second cycle, a frozen cycle of IVF this time, because we had some embryos in the freezer. And that happily resulted in a pregnancy that went almost a full term. We'll talk about that. My son was born last May at 36 weeks. So the whole journey, probably, I think it's about 7 years that it took us to have that outcome. And that's a long time. It's a long period of your life to be effectively in limbo. I have managed to write a whole book about it, so I won't talk too much about it here. But it is, I think, important, especially if you end up going on to have a healthy pregnancy and a live birth. I think it is important to acknowledge that we have been there in that place, to let other people know that you're not alone. We weren't alone. That was my single biggest takeaway from that period of my life, I think, was that I was not as alone as I felt. And that doesn't mean you feel actually fundamentally any less alone, but it is still a comfort to know that. So yeah, I found myself, as you say, finally pregnant towards the end of 2019. And I think at that point in my journey, I couldn't take anything for granted. So I kind of had the positive test and I had a fairly muted response to it. You know, I was happy, obviously, but there was always that bit of my brain at that point going, well, but you know, it might not stick. Things might go wrong in unexpected ways, because it did feel like every time something happened to me and I thought I knew what to expect next time, something new would happen.
Yeah.
And I had a bit of bleeding even before I took the test, actually. Had a tiny bit of bleeding. And then I had a bit of bleeding about a week after I took the test. So still very early on, before my first scan at the clinic. And at each point, I just kind of thought, well, I know at this point I can't control what happens, but I also can't assume anything. So I can't assume that this bleeding means that something's going to go wrong. I just have to wait and see. I can say that now with a lot more kind of confidence than I felt at the time, because it doesn't mean that you don't feel terribly anxious just because you know that you have to wait and see.
Mention here, you had bleeding in your previous pregnancies, yes, that had ended in miscarriage.
Exactly.
And ectopic pregnancy.
So every pregnancy I'd had up until that point, and this was my fifth pregnancy, which sounds really odd to me to say that, because of course you don't necessarily, I certainly didn't necessarily think of it as adding up to five pregnancies at that point, but in every single one I'd had bleeding, and that had subsequently ended in either, as you say, miscarriage, or in the case of the ectopic, I ended up with surgery to remove my fallopian tube. So I was very attuned to like the emotional response to that being something's going to go wrong. Before I ended up miscarrying, I had bleeding, you know, then we'd seen a heartbeat. So I was aware of the fact that it could be nothing or it could be something, which is unfortunately like my mantra throughout that entire pregnancy was, it could be nothing, it could be something.
It's so hard, isn't it? And
yeah.
And we try and tell ourselves, you know, like that every pregnancy is different, you know, every pregnancy is different. It's
exactly
not the same as the last one. But if you're getting those signs and you have been through that, then, you know, that's a really, really difficult thing. So how did you get through those days?
Well, I just was really zoned out. I was very tired, but I didn't have a lot of other physical symptoms, which was true of all my pregnancies. And again, that was one of those, actually, I kind of wanted to be the woman who was throwing up in the tube carriage because I felt so ill, because it was like, I thought that would be comforting to me. But I mean, I'm obviously very glad that I wasn't, because I felt pretty much okay. I just felt exhausted all the time. And my husband at that point was commuting to London, so we weren't seeing much of each other during the week. And I just had this very like rhythmic weekday life where I would do my work. I worked from home primarily. I was also doing some lecturing. So I had a few points in the week where I had to be elsewhere, but mostly I could kind of just be in my little cocoon. It's a very privileged position to be in, but I could kind of set myself up in my office or on the couch, and I could do things to distract myself. I did find, in my case, work was quite helpful for that, but for some people, I think that's probably not the case. It just depends. And I could watch Netflix in the evenings and cook myself dinner. And like, it's just, it's now this big blur of like, I think I was just really trying not to dig too deep into what I actually was feeling or thinking about. In the early stages, it was so abstract and so much like, I guess until I got beyond the points that I'd got to in previous pregnancies, I felt a little bit like I was just playing out this very familiar routine, and we had no idea what was going to happen. The furthest I'd ever got was 12 weeks, pretty much exactly. And once we got beyond that point with this pregnancy and we had our official 12-week scan, we'd had several scans previously because, of course, we'd undergone fertility treatment. But once we got past that official 12-week scan, I started to feel like, oh, okay, we're in uncharted territory here. Everything from here on out, we've never experienced. So in some ways, it's easier because I don't have a bunch of previous experiences to hold it up to. But in some ways, it's terrifying now because I don't have anything else to compare it to. And it was, I think, you know, at each of these milestones, I remember going to see the midwife at the 16-week appointment and then the 20-week scan. And each one felt like I should be getting more relaxed, but actually I really fundamentally could never relax. I don't think there was a moment in that pregnancy, apart from possibly while I was actually being scanned and seeing that things were okay, I don't think there was a moment that I sat back and thought, okay, now I can relax. I know everything's fine.
I think that there will be people nodding along. I know that I'm nodding along to that. It's like, yeah, well, can you just follow me around and and have that at all times? So that
exactly.
Please.
I guess the sad thing is that all of the experiences that I'd had up until that point, miscarriages, infertility, had kind of taught me to mistrust my own body a bit, which I think is a very familiar thing for people who go through this. You end up with this dissonance where you understand that your body is your body and you need to make a home with it no matter what happens, but you're not sure you can trust it to do the things that you think it's supposed to do. And so the whole pregnancy was really an exercise in kind of trying to rebuild some of that trust that had been lost. Never mind the fact that then there's also this little invisible creature inside that you have to also put your faith in, even though you've never met. And a lot of the language around, you know, if you're kind of worried, and I would call up the MAU, the maternity assessment unit, and they would say, well, you know your baby best. If you're worried, you should come in. We're totally happy to see you. And I remember thinking, but I don't know him. Like, I know that he's there, but I'd never met him. I've seen him on a screen for, 10 seconds, but I don't know who this person is. I have no idea what's normal. And that's really hard because it is an exercise in faith. Like, you have to try to figure out ways of like tricking yourself into having confidence and having that trust in your body that's been damaged over the years, I think.
Yeah, completely. And that is a really difficult thing for them to essentially put on you, isn't it? Because then you're left wondering, well, do I know them? Is this normal? And you try and go with your gut, but then you feel guilty for not knowing them and feeling like you don't know whether this is regular. So I guess essentially it's like, go in. If you're worried, go in. It's not necessarily about like trusting your baby, or it's a bit of a gut instinct. And if it's not even your gut, it's just like, I'm not sure, so I'm going to go and check.
But also, and the thing is that I guess I got very hung up on the idea that somehow my gut instinct was going to tell me what was going on. And in fact, all the gut instinct is telling you is that you need reassurance.
Yes.
So, you know, it's not that if I felt worried, it's because my gut was telling me that something was wrong and something was wrong. My gut was telling me that I needed somebody to say, no, look, everything's fine, or not. I was trying to read too much into it. So, you know, I would get kind of into this cycle of thinking, oh, I'm worried. Oh God, the fact that I'm worried must be a sign that something is wrong. And actually it's just that you're worried, which is a very normal response to pregnancy, no matter what your story is. I guess maybe that's the thing that you have to kind of learn or train yourself into believing, is that actually, absolutely, if you feel you need to go in or that you have any doubts, that's exactly what you should do. But it's not because something is definitely wrong.
I think that's a really, really fair assessment. But the thing is, if you are feeling like that, go in and get checked. Yeah. I've never spoken
and they,
to a midwife.
They want you to.
Don't do it. Yeah, exactly.
And even during the pandemic. So I think, you know, of course, I was saying every time I felt like I knew what to expect, something new would happen. So the new thing in this case was, oh, global pandemic. So,
oh my goodness. So how far along were you at that point? About 20 weeks or so?
So it was a little past 20 weeks. I mean, obviously things kind of, I remember going, oddly enough, going into London in January to see a friend, just as like the news was starting to break that this was happening. And it felt very far away at that point. You know, it was kind of confined to China. And I remember sitting on the train thinking, oh, that would be so stressful to have to worry about. But, you know, I, like at that point, I didn't really think that that was going to be the case. And of course, you know, less than 2 months later, there we were. But yeah, I was about 20 something, maybe 24 weeks or so in March when things really started to get serious. And we had booked this trip to Paris, which I remember, like, it was supposed to be this very glamorous, like, it's our last trip together before the baby is going to come, which again, like, for me, it was very hard to acknowledge these things, like, oh, our life really is going to change. We are going to have a baby. But it, you know, it was supposed to be kind of romantic, lovely, relaxing few days in Paris, take the train. It was just, it was so not that. And we kept, you know, looking at all the advice. At that point, it was like international travel is totally fine unless you're going to these very specific places. So we went, and on the way there, everything sort of still felt normal. And by the time we got on the Eurostar to come back, you could just tell that there had been a major shift in what was going on. Everybody was anxious. We were staying across the street from a pharmacy, and they put up this sort of handwritten note that said, we don't have any masks, we don't have any hand sanitizer. We came back from that. That was about 24 weeks. I went to see my GP for a regular appointment. And I guess at that point, because I'd reached, maybe it was 25, 26 weeks around then, I'd reached a point where they said, look, you're almost there. Like, you're at the point of, you know, viability. Like, if you feel you need to be seen more often, we're happy to have you in. And then like a week later, we went into lockdown, and it was just like, oh, okay, that does change things. Because it wasn't that anyone was telling me that I couldn't still have reassurance, but I didn't know what to do, what to feel, how comfortable to be kind of rocking up to the hospital for scans that I didn't actually need. And yeah, so we went basically into hibernation. And that was very difficult because obviously it was a difficult time for everyone. It was anxiety inducing. There were a lot of things that we didn't understand that we perhaps understand a bit better now, but it was very uncertain. I had a very small bump. It was winter, the early pregnancy. So I was like, I was in these big clothes. Nobody could tell I was pregnant. And I was finally starting to show. And I think I'd always really wanted to be like visibly pregnant in public. And then I just didn't, like, I left the house to go on these little walks with my husband around the, like the same walk around our neighborhood. And that was it. For weeks, like nobody witnessed my pregnancy, which doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. It's not like it wasn't happening, but there was something very odd about like my family and my community not being able to kind of see it happen.
And you're not the first person that I've heard talk about that. You know, I think that there is somewhat, you know, a grief around, you know, it not being what we had expected, which we've experienced already going through our trying to conceive journey, and that not being what, you know, it was supposed to be, like you said at the beginning, you know, the enjoyable bit, a kind of rolling the hay and lovely. But yeah, so how did you reconcile with that? Like, I know that you said that, you know, the it was happening still, you know, irrelevant of people seeing it or not. So you're an American in the UK.
That's
so,
right. Yeah.
So I guess your family in the US wouldn't have seen your growth anyway, but is that comparable in any way?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because I'd been very fortunate that my parents had come over actually that Christmas. So I was pregnant. I was over 12 weeks at that point. We shared the news with them. And so they've been able to be with us for a little part of that journey. And I'm so grateful now. I haven't seen them since then. So I'm so grateful now that they were there, and they did actually get to be a part of the pregnancy for a short period of time. And of course, they wouldn't have seen me, you know, in that way. And actually, my relationship with my family in California was probably the most unaltered by the pandemic, because that's how we've kind of, you know, we've always FaceTimed. But I think it was that they were planning to come out around my due date to kind of be there in the early stages of my son's life. And that didn't happen. And we knew, I think, fairly early on in the pandemic that wasn't going to be very likely. My husband's family is based here near where we live. So we are very used to having a kind of a family life, and everybody in our immediate family knew what we'd been through and how worrying it was. And so it was strange to suddenly be cut off from just the normal kind of intimacies of life like that at a point when you feel like you kind of want it most. There's something reassuring about knowing that there are other people around you when you're going through something that's a bit stressful, even though it's wonderful and life-changing.
Well, that's the thing, because it is really stressful and there is a lot of anxiety, but it's also wonderful.
Yeah.
So I guess, like, I can imagine, and I guess thinking back to my pregnancy where I did have that, it's kind of, you want to get caught up in the joy, you know, like, yes, we're dealing with our anxiety.
Yeah.
But you want people to say, oh my gosh, you're pregnant. Oh my gosh. Oh, wow. How far along are you? And all of those conversations that you had thought about.
And I think that's a really good way of putting it or thinking about it. And that's exactly what I craved, was like, I could only get caught up in the joy of it via other people's enthusiasm, if that makes sense. And I remember a neighbor of ours, so we could sort of see them over the fence. And, you know, I remember her saying, like, she was so excited for us, but in a way that I couldn't quite feel, because I was the one going through it. But it helped me to know that somebody else was actually excited, and it made me feel excited. And of course, I was excited, but it was like I needed the inspiration of those responses to kind of get me out of the rut of, actually, this is just something that I'm worried about, and to help me remember that it's also a joyful experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I talk about people kind of, you know, like, and my hands are going right now for anyone listening, but kind of like grabbing back, you know, those moments you know, we are going to be anxious during our pregnancies. Yeah. Like, unfortunately, my experience and the experience of hundreds, if not thousands of women I've spoken to, is that we are going to be anxious during our pregnancies.
Yeah.
But we want to try not to kind of give in to that anxiety all the time. And we want to, like, steal some of those moments of joy back. And actually, you say, kind of getting that inspiration and that joy from other people is just one way of doing that, which was kind of taken away from you and so many others during that period.
So many people, yeah.
Now, you mentioned there that your family were due to come over around your due date. Now, for anyone who hasn't heard this before, a due date is kind of like an anticipated around that time. It's not a specific.
Yeah.
However, your son came particularly early, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. So my due date was the 21st of June, it was Father's Day, which was a lovely... obviously, we knew that it was very unlikely he would actually be born on that day, but there was something very poetic about that. And I just assumed that I would be late, because everyone I knew who'd had a first baby recently had been, you know, either induced or been fairly overdue. My mother had been induced with me. Like, I just assumed that would be the case. And I was planning to work up until like a week or so before my due date. So I was just blithely kind of ignoring the fact that I actually probably needed to start preparing. We did an online NCT class, although doing it online is a bit different. I'm very glad we did, because it did force me to start thinking a bit more seriously about the mechanics of birth and the choices that might be available to me and the logistics of what you need to bring and think about. And we did that sometime in sort of mid-May, when to me it felt like we still had a long time to go. And I had plenty of time to really think about all that. I could process it sort of superficially, and then I could really think about it. And I hadn't had my conversation yet with my midwife about my birth plan. I was very open-minded about my birth plan, to be honest. I'm not sure if I had that conversation before I gave birth, which I didn't in the end. I'm not sure I really would have had a very set plan, but I really, like, I just hadn't, I don't know, I hadn't quite come to terms with the fact that I was actually going to be giving birth, which again, I think is quite common amongst people who've had trouble conceiving or kind of keeping pregnancies. So we got, to, I think, 35 weeks and 2 or 3 days. And I lost my mucus plug. And then a day or two later, and I phoned the MAU at that point, and they said, oh, it's fine. It happens. You're very unlikely to suddenly go into labor. You might actually form a new mucus plug, you know, whatever, but you're probably fine. Obviously, if anything changes, you know, call us back or come up. But they weren't concerned. It didn't occur to me at that point that I was going to go into labor particularly early. But then my waters broke. And that was fairly definitive at that point. It was like, okay, something's definitely happening. And so we went up to the hospital. Thankfully, my husband had been a bit more proactive, and he'd actually started packing the hospital bags. I was there, but I think I didn't want to engage in that process because it involved kind of moving into the next phase of trust and faith, which was that I was making an assumption that I was going to be giving birth and having a baby. And I was struggling to do that a little bit. So I sort of sat there while he went through his spreadsheet of things that we should pack and what we had and what we needed to order. And again, because of the pandemic, he started thinking about that a lot earlier than we normally would, because we didn't know how long it would take for, I mean, it's stupid, but like, we ordered all our clothes and buggy and crib and all that, like, really early, because we didn't know how long it would take to get. We had a lot of trouble finding newborn size clothing online because there were stock issues. Thankfully, he actually wanted to sit and address that earlier than I did, because if we'd waited for my timeline, we would have been very underprepared for what happened. But we drove up to the hospital with these bags that were sort of almost packed, not quite, but almost packed. And I was sitting on like a big puppy training pad that somebody had given me because I was leaking everywhere. And I think even at that point, like, I guess I knew that things were happening, but I hadn't quite wrapped my head around the fact that I might be giving birth in a matter of hours or days. And I was, still 35 weeks and 3 days, I think. And they admitted me to the MAU, the maternity assessment unit. And of course, my husband couldn't come in because this was, still lockdown at this point, no visitors. But I think even then I was like, they'll assess me and then they'll let me out. And of course, what they did was they assessed me and they gave me so I hadn't had my 36-week scan yet. So they didn't know the position of the baby. And the doctor wanted to just do a very quick scan to figure out. And I was very uncomfortable at this point. I'd had a lot of rib pain, which was not alleviated by anything. Like, I couldn't stay in one position for very long. So I think was sort of not entirely surprised to learn that my son was breech. He was head up, like right jammed in my ribs. And so they said at that point, you're going to probably be looking at a cesarean because it's very unlikely that he's going to turn around at this stage. And I have a funny shaped womb, so there's not a tremendous amount of space for him to do so. And as I say, I hadn't thought through what my birth was going to look like, what I wanted it to look like. Really, what I wanted was a baby who was healthy. And that was, that's everyone's goal. And in my case, like, I felt pretty confident. My whole pregnancy, my conception had been very kind of medicalized because of the IVF. I didn't have any aversions to the idea of a cesarean. I just hadn't really thought about what I wanted. And as soon as he said that, there was a little bit of me that was slightly relieved because I thought, okay, well, that's one less thing that I need to worry about in terms of decision-making or not knowing what's going to happen. Like, at least there's something there that's been decided. And I did look, there were these posters on the walls in the room where they, sort of different birthing positions. And I remember thinking, oh, well, I guess that doesn't really apply to me. I'll never know what that's like with this pregnancy. But then that, I moved on. Like, it didn't seem to me that one option was better than the other. And in my case, I think having all the experiences leading up to that in some ways makes you more resilient when it comes to how completely out of control birth really is. You know, you can plan as much as you want, but there's nothing that you can do to ensure that it's going to go the way you want it to. And so having had every experience of my fertility journey so far reinforcing that message was actually quite helpful at that stage.
And so how did it, how did it go? Was it?
So what happened is at that point, they admitted me to hospital because they didn't know whether I was going to go into labor imminently. They didn't want me to be stuck at home. We live very close to the hospital, but they still didn't want me to be stuck at home and suddenly find myself in the late stages of labor with a breech baby that I couldn't safely deliver on my own. So I was in the hospital and they do like steroid shots to stimulate the baby's lung growth at that point in case you deliver really early.
Because I guess what they want is for the baby to stay in there as long as possible.
Yes. And I remember one of the doctors saying, you know, it used to be that actually we would immediately do the cesarean at this point, but we try to get babies as close to full term as we possibly can. So what they wanted to do was schedule me for a cesarean at exactly 37 weeks, which would have been like a week and a few days after I was admitted, which sounded great to me because then I knew exactly where we were aiming for. But of course, they can't control whether you go into labor before that. And in my case, I did. I was in the hospital for a couple of days and I was having some sort of mild cramping, which I think is one of the reasons they kept me in, because they didn't, as I say, want it to suddenly develop into sort of something that I needed to be in hospital for. So I was just on my own in this hospital room for like a couple of days. There's a little park by the hospital. So I was like allowed, I could sign myself out. It felt like being back in like, I don't know, in school or something, like you could sign yourself out to go and have a walk in the park with your boyfriend. So I, you know, I could see my husband briefly. He could bring me things because obviously I hadn't anticipated being in hospital for quite that long. And then I started to go into labor. Interestingly, and I think this is, you know, one of the problems with this happening in the pandemic is that like they were so understaffed and stressed and I was stressed and it was a heat wave. It was so hot. I mean, the hospital is so hot. And I was like just lying there sort of sweating. And nobody actually sort of said, oh, you're in labor at any point. And the whole thing about birth partners at that point was that you could have one when you were in what they called active labor, but you kind of needed somebody to say, you're in active labor, you can bring your partner in now. And this never really happened for me. Like I was experiencing incredibly bad contractions, but I didn't know they were contracting. They kept saying, oh, you're having some tightenings. And I thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. I don't know how I'm going to cope with actual labor. Because I'm barely, you know, I was on the phone to my husband at one point and like, I couldn't speak to him for periods of time. And he was like, are you having contractions? And I said, oh no, they're just little tightenings. And inside I was thinking, oh no, I don't know how I'm going to kind of cope with what's coming. But eventually, and it was, you know, it was a Saturday night, the middle of the night. So it was just all a bit stressful. And eventually somebody sort of thought, oh, actually, we should probably check the baby's heartbeat and kind of make sure that everything's okay. And they could see at that point that with each tightening, his heartbeat was decelerating. So they moved me then down to a delivery suite. And I said, oh, should I kind of let my husband know? And they said, well, no, let's see where we are, you know, see how far dilated you are. So I texted him. It was like, you know, 2 a.m. at this point. He didn't get it because he was asleep, but I texted him and said, oh, just so you know, I'll let you know. And I got down there and eventually the doctor came and kind of, you know, had a look and said, oh, I can see a foot. We need to get you into theater right now.
Oh, my goodness.
And so at that point, I was like, can I call my husband yet? Now? Yes. Yeah, you better call him. I hope you don't live too far away. And so he, thankfully, middle of the night, no traffic. He made it to the hospital in record time, just in time to actually be present for the birth, thankfully. So we did at least have that, you know, he was there at that moment. Not that I had an image of what birth was going to be like, apart from, you know, I think we all have a vague image based on kind of what we've seen, how we've seen it portrayed, maybe what we ideally would want. But like, I hadn't really imagined it being that lonely. And again, it's the idea of like, there is no one person, because of course I was attended to by an array of spectacularly kind and wonderful midwives, but there's no one single person who saw that birth from start to finish, if you know what I mean, apart from me. So like, I have to rely entirely, and I probably don't know all the details. I'm probably misremembering things. I have to rely entirely on my very cloudy memory of how my birth happened.
Do you know that you can go back to your hospital and have your notes read to you? Okay, that's
good. I didn't do it because I didn't. Well, I mean, post birth is a whole other story. But I was in a weird haze for a long time, which I think is very common.
And you don't need to do it immediately. Like I did mine several weeks later, but I think, well, certainly with my hospital, you can go for up to 5 years afterwards.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's just and just for anyone listening as well, the reason I found out about it was because I was speaking at a midwife college actually about kind of the transition from fertility clinic to NHS care. And some of the tutors there are highly experienced midwives. And they were saying that it's a really good thing to do anyway, because as you say, you know, you don't really know what's going on, or what's happening. And I know I've recalled like experiences that I had during my labor, and Bob's like, no, it didn't quite happen like that. So, you know, it's kind of my version. But actually, specifically, if you have had a traumatic birth for any reason, that's what these people were saying to me, that it can be really like either validating, or it can actually let you know that it wasn't quite as traumatic as perhaps you're remembering, you know, and the facts are there, which can help you with the healing of that trauma. And yeah, so there's lots of different reasons to do it. But yeah, do talk
about that's a very good point. And they, I mean, I guess it depends on where you are, but they were very good at telling us that when they kind of discharge you, they give you all the information. But I was in hospital for another 7 days after that. So I had a lot of time to sit in the hospital setting and reflect. And that was, I mean, in some ways, that was probably the most difficult thing, because my husband was there for the birth for about 2 hours afterwards. I think it was supposed to be one, and they were very kind about stretching that as much as they could. And they keep you in for 24 hours after a cesarean, no matter what. So we thought, oh, I'll see you in a day, be fine. But because my son Felix was born at 36 weeks, exactly, in fact. So only a week preterm, which in kind of prematurity terms is not massive, but it is still preterm. He needed treatment a couple of times under the lights. He struggled to feed. So they had a few issues that they wanted to make sure were ironed out before I was discharged. But again, I don't think anybody had really thought through at that point what it meant to keep a new parent and their premature baby in a hospital setting for a week without any external support whatsoever. And I actually found the recovery from my cesarean relatively good, actually, thankfully. But it was still, you know, you're sore no matter what. Like it's quite a major surgery. And so like having to kind of take care of my baby by myself, to try to take care of myself. I mean, I think I took like two showers the entire time I was there. I remember at one point the pediatrician came to talk to me, and I looked down at myself and I was like, oh my God, he just must think that I am some sort of feral being. Like I was still wearing my stockings, you know, the whatever they're called, the pressure ones. Yeah. But they had like blood stains on them. I was wearing my hospital gown and these, you know, massive pants underneath. And I hadn't washed or brushed my hair in days. And I was such an absolute mess. And of course, your priority at that point is looking after your child. And of course, if I'd had somebody there, they could have done some of that for me so that I could have, like, I don't know, felt a bit more human. But it was like a very animal experience. I was like, okay, I'm literally just here to look after my baby until I can go home and have somebody look after me.
Yeah, because that's the thing, because I remember going for my first shower. I remember the first poo was the worst one. I don't know how you felt about that. Yeah. People don't talk about it, but you're like, oh my God.
I have a funny story about that, actually.
And we might end with that then. Yeah. We'll look forward to that. But the first shower as well, like it's somewhat monumental to do it. Yeah. And I had, you know, Bob or my mum were with Ren in the hospital looking after her. So I knew that I could just take myself off, very slowly and kind of get that done. So, like, I'm impressed that you even had a couple of showers.
Well, I had one of them. I took him in with me because they have these big cubicles and you can do it. And I was like, I don't know. I felt a bit weird. I was like, won't it be like hot and steamy? And like, they were like, no. You can just take him, wheel him in his little cot. He'll be fine. But the second time I had
okay. So he was in the cot. I thought he was in the cot.
Oh no.
My goodness. That's no, amazing.
It's a massive kind of cubicle. Yes, and the I'm second time a nurse looked after him so that I could have a shower because I was clearly like about to break down.
Oh, bless you. Bless you.
But, and that was, I will say, it was such a lonely experience, but also the staff at that hospital they're absolutely heroic because they were under enormous pressure. They were clearly, they didn't have enough people. They were having to do the jobs of, you know, these qualified, incredibly experienced midwives having to like fetch water for people or hold their hands while they sobbed because nobody else was there to do that. I think they had a really hard time, but they took such good care of everyone.
We just need to also take a moment to think about the partners who are missing out on that.
Exactly.
And it's just so upsetting and like that doesn't even cover it. So my only experience of that, and we will get to the poo story now, because but my only experience of that is we've been told for our treatment that we're currently undergoing that Bob can't come in for the transfer. And even that was quite upsetting. So, you know, and that is
quite upsetting because that's a major part of it.
It is, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, like I'm allowed to do this because it's comparing myself. But I think that that's not as bad as, you know, you were there for a week. And
I do think, you know, as much as it was not pleasant for me, I think he got the worst deal there. I was there and I was, every time I felt, you know, terrible about being stuck there and not quite knowing how to wrap my head around being a parent, I had my son there, like he was right next to me.
Yeah.
And my husband didn't really get to meet him for a week.
Yeah, that's incredibly sad.
And he would come, like he was dropping things off. Like we brought three nappies with us in the bag because we didn't know how many we needed. And we're like, three's fine. We won't be there for that long. So he kept having to bring me stuff like nappies. And I could see, I was near a window and I could see him like drive up and I would hold Felix up to the window and he could like wait, but we were like five floors up. So he could barely see us, but it was like, it was just, you know, that's not the experience you want as a family, is to be able to be together, really.
And we understand, you know, I say this every time we kind of complain about everything that we've been through during COVID, and we're allowed to do that, you know, that's okay. You know, we do obviously understand the impact and the loss and the trauma that it was impact, like having on so many people. So this is the right thing to have happened.
Yeah.
However, it doesn't mean that it wasn't traumatic.
Absolutely. And I think my hope would be that we can learn from the experiences of people who've had to go through some of these things alone, that maybe we can find ways of supporting them better in the future in these kinds of situations.
Absolutely.
However that might manifest.
Yeah. But the good news is you did get home and your son is it 13, 14 months?
Yeah, now? almost 14 months now.
Wow.
Toddling around.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And I know we've talked previously about baby sign and that kind of thing and how I'm such a huge fan. But before we go, but just because we are coming out of time now, I need to, I built it up.
It's not, it's not going to be that exciting now. But so this is the pediatrician story that I was telling, was that, you know, I'm looking at myself thinking, God, I'm such a mess. And I had finally my first poo at this point. And at one point, and the pediatrician obviously is interested in the baby, that's kind of his job. And like one of the things that I felt when I was in hospital is that because everyone's focus was on the baby, like I wasn't really necessarily being asked questions about my own health. You sort of have to advocate for yourself as a person separate from the baby. And I wasn't, I guess, really listening or thinking about the context of kind of why the, you know, the pediatrician was like looking over my son and asking about things like, you know, his behavior and stuff. And he said, oh, any bowel movements? And I just said, oh yes, I've just had one. then, looking really proud of myself. And then he looked at me and I just, you could see his face, like he didn't know what to do. And he was like, oh no, I meant,
oh no,
has the baby done it? And I was like, Oh, I see.
Oops.
It's
although
not about me. but you know, now he knows.
Yep.
yeah. And that, yeah. And that was the point where I was like, oh my God, okay, I am a mess. And I can't quite keep anything straight in my head, but I hope that gave him a laugh later, at least.
I'm sure it, I have no doubt. And it has given me one, I'm afraid. I'm sorry. And no, I can totally understand why you would have said that.
I was I have. This is good progress, isn't it?
It is, because they do ask you.
They
you know, that
you,
is a
yeah.
thing. And there's a whole, so if anyone is pregnant now, and I'm not going to go into this in loads of detail right now, but I should do at some point, or maybe with a professional perhaps, to describe it. But they do have instructions on how you should go to the toilet after you've given birth, because it is delicate. And I suspect it's exactly the same if you have an abdominal birth, if you have a vaginal birth. I had an episiotomy, so I was really worried about the stitches. But you kind of put your feet on a stool, you know, like the stools that toddlers stand on in front of a sink, like that kind of to lift that up. And then I did have like a pad that I held just to like hold everything together. I was so nervous. Like even things like that, when you haven't got someone looking after the baby, never mind a shower, just going to the bathroom. Yeah. But thank you so much. Sorry that we digressed then about the poo. I just got a little bit.
No, I think it's great. And this is, you know, these are the things that, as you
no
say,
we
don't,
you.
You don't think about. And especially when your whole focus has been getting pregnant, staying pregnant. Okay. You know, and having a positive outcome, actually sometimes the details get a little lost.
Totally.
And it's good to think about those and to acknowledge how ridiculous the whole thing is.
Yes. Yes. Totally ridiculous and absolutely wonderful.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So, so delighted that you have sat with me today and shared your story and that
thank you so much for having me.
Felix is here safe and sound.
Yes.
That's just brilliant. And yeah, there will be, as I said at the beginning, a link in the show notes to grab a copy of your fantastic book and come and find you on socials as well.
Yeah, great. Super. Thank you so much, Kat.
Have a fabulous day. Take
you
care.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye.